Okay, we are learning Malachim Aleph. We are in the 11th chapter, Perikud Aleph. We are up to Pasuk Chaf Gimel on page 122. We've been discussing in this last chapter, literally the last chapter of King Solomon's life, about some things, unfortunately, that he didn't do all that properly, including having 1,000 wives, horses, and a whole bunch of money and power, and perhaps, dare I say, some levels of going against the words of the Torah, which explicitly says he's not allowed to do certain these things. Because of that, he's punished. The punishment is a split. A split, a lack of unity among the Jewish people for the first time. And as this split takes place, we'll see that it continues for many, many years thereafter. It will not happen in the times of Shlomo's life, but rather it will happen in the time of his son, who will take over his position of power, namely Rehoboam. He'll end up being the king, but not the king of all 12 tribes, but only a small portion, only two of the tribes, namely them that of Yehuda and Benjamin, the tribe of Binyamin. And we'll see who the other person who will take over the 10 tribes. We're going to see that shortly. We mentioned that there were people who were with Satan. Satan, English translated as Satan, but Satan means an antagonist. Because the Satan, which is also our Yetzirah, causes us to do things perhaps that we shouldn't do. And people also from external outside sources can also cause us pain and harm. The person that we were introduced to that was the first antagonist was Hadad Ho'adomi, who always had the king's number because of what happened many years back in the times of David, that his nation or his people were persecuted. After all, he did come from Edom, Esav, namely the grandfather of Amalek, and therefore absolute punishment is a requirement by the Torah. Exactly how we understand that law is difficult, but regardless, he became the first antagonist. Even though he ran to the king of Egypt, he said in Pasuk Beis, in verse 22, which was the last sentence we saw last week, that he wanted to go back to his original land, as though to reconnect to the days of yesteryear. But the truth was, his motivation was to antagonize and to cause problems for the leader, for the king. Now we see another antagonist who also is not as familiar as the third that we will see soon. Let's now continue Pasuk Chaf Gimel. Vayakim Elokim bo Satan es Rezon ben Elyada. A second person who is an antagonist against the king was Rezon ben Elyada. And what was so unique about this second antagonist, Rezon ben Elyada? Asher barach me'es Hadad Ezer Melech Tzayva Adonav. That, telling us a little bit about who he was a person, Asher Barach, that ran away from his master, whose name was Hadad Ezer, who was the king of Tzova. So, he ran away in order to be able to also cause problems to the king, to Shlomo. But it's interesting, it doesn't say that the antagonists came on their own. But it was, as the verse says, Vayakim Elokim, that God allowed this to happen. As though to say, these individuals always wished to persecute and cause problems to the king. However, it was only after Shlomo had made all these mistakes that God allowed them to be able to be effective in causing him problems. Pasuk Chaf Dalet then continues. It says, V'yikbots olav anash, that he gathered together people, that it's not enough to have one person causing problems against the king, but he needed to be able to gather a group of people to rally on his side. Vayisar gedud, baharug David osam. And as the pasuk says, that together with the people that he gathered, he became the leader of this nation, of this army, baharug David osam. And the reason was because David had tried also to cause him harm, to kill him. V'yelchu Damasek, v'yeshuvah. So they went to this place called Damasek, translated as Damascus. V'yeshuvah, and he dwelled there. V'yimluchu b'Damasek. And he ended up ruling in this place called Damasek. Okay, let's just see this next sentence. We'll finish up with this person. But he sought to Yisrael, and he was an antagonist, not just to the king, but to Yisrael. Because the leader represents the will of the greater Jewish community, the Jewish world. And therefore, upon causing harm to the king, it's as though you're causing problems for everyone. And it wasn't just for a few moments, but Kol Yimei Shlomo, all of his days, Yasaro Asher Hadad, and it wasn't just Razon, but Hadad together with Razon, putting their evil ways and their plots to harm the king together, would be more effective. V'yakatz v'Yisrael v'yimoch al Aram. And this verse concludes and says that together with Hadad, he despised Yisrael. It wasn't just against the king, it was against Yisrael. He represented the Jewish people. V'yimuch al Aram. And he ruled over this place called Aram. So let's, for a moment, look at the English on page 123. On page 123, we find on the top left side, it says as follows. Solomon's second antagonist was Razon, son of Eliada. When David resoundingly defeated this king, Hadad-Ezer, Razon, a servant of the king, escaped. He became the leader of a warrior band that conquered Damascus and settled there. Eventually, they came to rule over the entire country of Aram, and they accepted Razon as their king. So you see that he became this powerful person. As I mentioned, if you look further in the English to next paragraph, the second next paragraph, where it says, together with the evil of Hadad. On his own, Razon could not have been a significant antagonist against the powerful King Solomon. It was only because Hadad's hostility had paved the way that Razon was successful in harassing Solomon. We see the exact same thing with Amalek. The one thing that Amalek was known for was that they attacked us upon the road. And it says in the commentaries, Rashi states that it's comparable to a person who jumps into a scalding hot bath of water. You know 100% you're going to get burned, you're going to get third-degree burns, but they hated the Israel so much that they were willing to harm themselves so as to make that boiling hot water a little bit cooler for the next person. They said, you know what, I'm willing to sacrifice myself, so much do I hate this nation, in order to be able to allow the next nation to come along. That was the problem with Amalek. Amalek was the first person, first group, that caused problems to the Jewish people. And once that happened, then other people said, hey, I guess I could start up. And that's the same thing that happened over here with this person, Razon ben Eliada. He would have done nothing if it wasn't for the fact that Hadad stood up first. Once he saw that there were other antagonists involved, even though they may not have had the same motivation, they probably didn't even like each other. There's probably internal conflicts among these other two kings. But they had one agenda, to destroy the king, to destroy Klal Yisrael. And therefore, they were able to find that common ground between the two of them and ultimately cause problems for King Solomon. Now, what's interesting over here are a couple points. It's brought down over here, as we saw, that he was causing problems. And it says that he caused problems, verse 25 says, Kol Yimei Shlomo, all of Shlomo's life. Now the question is, we don't see that these people really have been causing problems to King Solomon his entire life. We see that we're being introduced to this concept now, but we haven't really seen so much of these individuals up until this point. So the Radak actually comments the third very wide line. It says, where the first word is Shinachem Alchet, it says in the Radak, V'yakir, it was noticed, Ki ba'od shahay ohev es Hashem. Provided that King Solomon was a believer in God, that he loved God, and he did the right things, Ein Satan, Ve'en Pegara, there was nothing that could harm him. Nothing could be a problem to him. V'kivan shechat, once he did a chet, once he sinned, with the things that he made a mistake in, Kamu HaSatanim. All of a sudden the antagonist came. as though to say, on some level, that they're waiting for a moment of weakness. They always hated him. They're waiting until finally he would show some signs of vulnerability. And at that moment, once he showed his weakness, then they were able to pounce on him. And that's what their motivation was. It wasn't necessarily that they all of a sudden hated him. It was really Kol Yimei Shlomo. They always, his entire life, hated him. But they had to wait until they were able to find the greatest moment, the greatest opportunity, which is when Solomon was at his weakest end, which is when he did not have the divine connection, that Hashem's relationship with him was severed, albeit a small amount. Regardless, at that moment they said, this is our one chance to be able to destroy the king. And therefore, again, it doesn't only mean Kol Yimei Shlomo, but it was all their life, all of Shlomo's life, they always hated it. It wasn't just it just happened when he sinned, and all of a sudden people started hating him. They always hated him. But they wanted to wait for the first opportunity to be able to potentially do him harm, which is only at the time of being vulnerable, which is exactly the motivation, similar to where Hadad Hadomi came from. Edom was a Molech. A Molech waited until we were Oyef V'Yageya. He waited until we were in the wilderness, weak and weary, and they hit us when we were at that most vulnerable point. That is what some enemies do, that they wait until we are very, very weak. And that's how I also have explained, as it's now this Parsha of Vayishlach, we find a very unusual section where Jacob is wrestling with an angel, right? And in that section we find that he was the angel was unsuccessful in harming Yaakov. So he ended up hitting him in a certain place in the sciatic nerve, the gid, and therefore because of that, no longer are we allowed to eat the gid hanasheh from an animal. The question is, well, because he hit him, all of a sudden we don't eat from this part? Like, what does one have to do with the other? So it's brought down in by the sages that the person, the angel, was not just an ordinary angel. It was a sarshel Esav. It was the angel of Esav, which of course, Esav is the grandfather of Amalek. The idea of what the Sarshal Esav did, when they were fighting fairly. And when he saw that, you know what, if I'm fighting against someone like Yaakov, I can't win. Because if I fight fairly, there's nothing I can do. What he did was literally hit him below the belt. And by hitting him in this area, this was a place of his weakness, which is precisely what a mullig does. And therefore, he was injured. And therefore, the idea of not eating from the sciatic nerve is not just to remember that he was hit, but it teaches us the same thing. That in the event that we ever have to fight, you always fight fairly. You don't hit below the belt, right? You don't add insult to injury. And that's what the mullig does. That's the motivation of being able to destroy your enemy at all costs, no matter what, with no rules, whatever it takes. And that's what happens here also. They waited until the moment that he was weakest, and that's when he pounced on him. That is not the way of a Yid. The way of a Jew is, of course, we always embrace peace. But sometimes, as it says in Ecclesiastes, in the order, it says, Eis melchama v'shalom. Sometimes the only time that you can get to peace is after war. Sometimes it's only on the other side of war. It's the very last resort. But even when we're engaged in melchama, there is ways of going about this war. It has to be done with dignity and respect as much as we possibly can, understanding not to do as the person, as the Sarshal Esav, so as to hit below the belt, to hit the Gid Hanasheh. That's something which we don't eat. That's not something we associate ourselves with. That's how we understand that concept in the Parsha. Anyway, so with that said, we now are going to be introduced to someone that we're going to be seeing not just for a few sentences as we did by Razon ben Eliada, but rather someone that will be found throughout many, many chapters, because he will end up taking over the majority position of power or as the next king of Israel. Again, we're now going to see that after Shlomo's reign has completed, it's over, his son, Rehoboam, will take over some position, but the next three words in Pasuk Vav will be the person who will take over the majority of power. 10 tribes of Israel. And who is that? Glad you asked. The Yerubim ben Nevat. The Yerubim ben Nevat Ephrasi. What does Ephrasi mean? So Radak says, Meshevet Ephraim. So you know right off the bat, he came from the tribe of Ephraim. He is not really supposed to be the king, because we know the king is a descendant of King David, right, from the tribe of Yehuda, right? Not the tribe of, like, King Saul. He didn't come, he came from Benjamin. He also was not supposed to reign permanently. That's why, as he made a small mistake, it was severed any connection. Even when Solomon made a mistake, still his children continued on some level to rule, because that is supposed to be the true tribe in which the leader will come forth, from the tribe of Yehuda. But here it says clearly that he did not come from Yehuda, he came from the tribe of Ephraim. Nothing wrong with the tribe of Ephraim, right? After all, it's one of Joseph's sons, right? But nonetheless, not a person in which that particular tribe would produce a king. We're going to see he is going to be the king. Min hasr, so, and then we describe a little bit more. Min hasreda, so he came from this place called Sreda. Hashem imo serua. Well, I know his mother. His mother's name was Serua. Ish almana. And she was an almana. She was a widow. Why do we need to know all these little facts about her, his mother? We'll have to see. There's different interpretations of what this means. Eved l'shlomo. At least at some point, he was subservient to the king. V'yarim yad b'melech. But ultimately, he lifted up his hand in defiance against the king. As we're going to see, the danger of appointing a person a position of power is all of a sudden they start thinking that they have a whole bunch of power. And they forget who gave them the power initially. We're going to see in a couple sentences that Shlomo looked at Yerubim as a person who has leadership qualities, and therefore he gave Yerubim certain things to do, certain tasks of leadership. Because of that, he felt that he had a right to speak up against the king, v'yarim yad b'melech, to stick his hand and to raise his hand up against the king. We'll discuss exactly what that is. Let's just see one more sentence. V'zeh davar asher harim yad b'melech. This is the matter in which he contested and that which he critiqued the king. What did he do? Shlomo b'na es hamilo. We mentioned before that Shlomo built this thing, this place called Milo, which is a place very close to the Beit HaMikdash. Sagar as parrot's ear, David Aviv. And he closed up various holes in the wall, various breaches, which was the city of David, his father. So there used to be, there was a lot of entrances in which you could go in all different directions to get to the Beit HaMikdash. For whatever reason, Shlomo sealed up and locked up, padlocked all those doors with only a few entrances. So when it came to going to the Beit HaMikdash, you can only go in a couple of ways. And as we're going to see, Yerubim and Nebat felt that what Shlomo did was not right. Felt what he did was not correct. And what exactly is the thing that he did which was so bad by locking a couple of doors? So that we'll see in a moment. So let's first look at some of the commentators over here. The Radak on Pasuk Chavav says, Yerubim ben Nevat. Who is Yerubim ben Nevat? What exactly is this person? So it says in the Radak, as he introduces us a little bit, Amru b'drash. It says in the Gemara in Masechta Sanhedrin on Kuf Aleph Amud Beis, Hu Nevat, Hu Micha, Hu Shiva ben Bichri. It says that he was really the same person. It's not Yerubim the son of Nevat, but really, he is the same person as Nevat, who was a Rasha. He was the same person as Micha, who was instrumental in having idols throughout the Jewish people. Hushava ben Bichri, who also caused problems. Now, some people say that, really, if you study the timeline of these different people, it's not possible it's the same person, but it's the same motivation. The same motivation was destruction. The same motivation was causing problems and antagonizing the king. That's one interpretation of why is he called Yerubim ben Nevat. If we look over here in the...
Did you have any mention of
them previously? Not really. Not that I'm familiar with. But Micha we are familiar with as someone who is involved in heavy Avodah Zarah, idol worship. And Shiva ben Bichri also, he rebelled against the king in a very public and open form.
Is there, excuse me,
Yeah. Is there also any reason why they mention his mother's name?
Yes, it's not mentioned in any of these commentators in front of us or in the English over here, but I'd like, since you brought it up, it does say the following. It's not in our packet, but let me just digress just for a moment and talk about the significance of his name. Yerovam, what does Yerovam mean? Yerovam, the commentators say, says it's comes from the word Meriva. Yerovam is the same root as Meriva. A riv is a quarrel, is a fight, is an argument. Which means he's a person who likes conflict, who likes causing problems. Not necessarily are all the problems legitimate or not legitimate. When things are going well and things are not going well, it doesn't matter. I need drama. I need to cause problems. I need to fight. That's what Yerovam was. He was a Ben Navat. He was a person who was always engaged in causing fights and problems. Who was he causing fights with? On one level, he was fighting against God. As it said, that later on, he is going to produce idol worship and say, you know what? You don't need to go to the temple. You don't need to go up on the pilgrimage festivals. Just go ahead and worship these idols, and that's good enough. That's just as good. So obviously, he caused a fight between idols and God, if you will, if we can say in the same sentence, as though to say that they're on equal footing. And therefore, he caused problems. Another interpretation of what was the fight. Again, he caused fighting and conflict among the Jewish people. He caused problems among the Jewish people. But why is it mentioned his mother's name? Why do we need to know that she was an Isha Almana? It's tragic. Okay, what does that additional piece have anything to do with the storyline? About the essence of this man? So, it's brought down in the commentators, not in our packet, that perhaps it's not talking about the mother. It's talking about who he was. He was a person that created among the Jewish people the concept of being an almana, being a widow. Where do we find that there's a concept of the Jewish people being like a widow? In the Book of Lamentations. In the beginning of on Tisha B'Av night, we read Eicha. And Eicha begins, Eicha yashva badad, that we're sitting in solitude, ha'isa ka'almana, and we are like a widow. So Isha almana is brought down in the commentators, it's not talking about his mother, he's saying what he caused Klai Israel to become. As it says, hu ha'yish, he was a person, shehoshiv es ami begolus, v'niu ba'almana, by disconnecting the Jewish people from the temple, and saying you don't have to go there, and causing division and machlokas, that is what destroyed the temple, and therefore ultimately making them as widows, disconnecting ourselves to the source of God. And therefore, he is considered to be an Isha, he is the Isha Almana. He is the person who created this disconnect between ourselves and God, like that of a widow. So that's how it's interpreted. Now, we look in English on page 123, give us another insight into the man behind this whole story. On page 123, where it says 2640, and then we're going to see for a few minutes a very unusual story which has to do with rending garments, it says like this. Of the three antagonists, Yerovam was the most historic, because he led the succession of the 10 tribes from Solomon's son, and became king of the 10 tribes that formed a northern kingdom, a breach that was never healed. His father was Navat, whom the Talmud in Sanhedrin identifies as either Micha, who set up an idol, etc., or perhaps someone else who rebelled against King David. Okay. So the first thing that's brought down over here is that a person, an individual, one person can cause enough problems and stand up against the leader that it can cause destruction for an entire nation. To the point that what this one person potentially can do by rallying a few other people can cause such division that it can never be restored. That is the danger of a Baal Machlokas, a person who wishes to cause problems. Continues the English on page 123. The Abarbanel comments that the sages did not mean to say that Yerovam was literally a descendant of Micha or Sheba, rather that he shared in their seditious, rebellious character. Yerovam was a distinguished scholar and strong leader. Obviously, he's not going to be picked to lead 10 tribes of Israel if he wasn't great. The Talmud explains that he earned his elevation to the kingdom because he was brave and principled enough to chastise Solomon when it was necessary. But he was punished because he did not do so publicly. Although the Torah requires that one should correct wrongdoers, one must be careful to do so without inflicting unnecessary pain. So even if you see that there's something that's being done which is wrong, there's a way of going about doing it. For you to do it in a way with much fanfare and to scream at a person at the top of your lungs is only going to humiliate that person, and you're not going to make the matters better, you're just going to cause more division and machlokas. If you really care, you go to the person individually and say, you know what, I saw you do X, Y, and Z. You probably shouldn't do it. It's a mistake. You are a king of Israel. He would have said, you know what, I appreciate you brought it to my attention. Thank you. And it would have been the end of it. The fact that he did it in public showed that his motivation was not because it was for the sake of heaven. His motivation was for himself. He wanted to be able to show that I'm greater than the king, that I can even chastise and humiliate a king. I'm better than he is. And ultimately, even though he might have said the right thing, it's where you say it. You have to be careful not only to speak, you have to know how to speak, and when to speak, and where to speak. What was this thing that he did that was so wrong? So we look at Rashi. Rashi says on page 122 like this. V'yorim yad melech. Rashi says in Pasuk Vav that he stood up against the king. Hochichu b'rav. Rashi says that he rebuked him in public. Can you imagine? A leader being humiliated in a public form. Not necessary. Do it privately. He did it b'rav. That was his mistake. V'zeh ha'davar. And therefore, obviously, if you're going to do it b'rabin, once you do it in that way, you're causing problems. So you're going to get conflict, because you could have rectified the situation quietly with proper communication. Instead, you decide to make a big deal about nothing, and therefore, all of a sudden, there's problems, and now there's going to be conflict. You caused the problems. V'zeh ha'davar she'hochichulav. Says Rashi, this is the matter which he rebuked him. Now, Rashi tells us, then we'll see in English, which will help us out a little bit better than the language of the Rashi. Shlomo banu asa Milo. Said that Shlomo built this Milo, which is this place near the temple. Levinian says Sagar as Peretz Eir David. And as the verse continued to say, he locked up a bunch of doors that were originally open the days of David. Shahoya ha Peretz Achori ha Milo. There were openings on the outside of the Milo, in the back. As Omarlo, he said, Avicha Peretz Peretzos Tuchoma. My father David made all these openings for what reason? L'chanes v'olei regalim. So people who are ascending during the pilgrimage festivals of Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuos, they'll be able to go through all these different passageways, through all these egresses. V'ato gedartosa. And you king, you close them up. You're making it difficult for people to go to the temple. Of course, we know that you think he really cared about the temple. He himself, later on, told people, don't go to the temple. Worship idols. But when you want to destroy someone, you look for any reason, even though you yourself don't believe in the reason. You don't care. You just want to put the other person down to make yourself look better. And why did you do this, king? Lasso is in Gari Labas Paro. You have 1,000 wives, and one of them happens to be the daughter of the king of Egypt, the pharaoh. And you wanted to be able to build this beautiful thing, this beautiful palace for this girl, to have a place for her servants, and therefore you decided to close up all the doors. There's only one or two openings, and guess what you decided to put there? An easy pass, before easy pass. Tolls, collectors of money, and then we all given to this girl that you love, who, by the way, is an Egyptian, right? This is the king, this is a Jewish king, this is the leader of Klal Yisrael. That's what he said, and he was right. On some level. Not necessarily did he do this in order to collect money. Shlomo was fabulously wealthy. It's preposterous to say that's the reason why he put a toll on the Marine Parkway Bridge to get another $2.75. He's a multi-billionaire. He doesn't need the money. Okay? And he's not crazed about money to get another billion. So obviously that's not his motivation. He closed up these doors. Maybe he shouldn't have. But there was a way to say it. He didn't have to embarrass him in front of everyone. Because obviously when you're dealing with money, people were like, hey, here's a point. That king has all this money. Now he's taking more of our money. So because of that, he caused a lot of problems. problems that could have easily have been solved if he spoke in private. Let's look in English on page 123. Milo was a place near the Beit HaMikdash, which was built for the princess. That's where he set up the daughter of Paro. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was a major palace near the Beit HaMikdash.
So,
he closed up a lot of the entrances near that area. To the only ways you can get into the Beit HaMikdash, David wanted as many doors as possible that people should go in all directions any way they can get in. And he locked up a lot of those doors so you can only go through this area in which was controlled by the queen, the daughter of Paro. And they put tolls on those bridges or on these entrances.
How do we know that they put tolls on it? It doesn't say it.
You're right. It's a little bit in English. You're right. It doesn't really say. But let's see the English, and then maybe let's look in the English. On page 123, Solomon had built up the Milo. David had left the Milo as an open courtyard for the convenience of the many pilgrims. It's almost Thanksgiving. Who had come to? We're cooking for Thanksgiving, so when I hear pilgrims, I don't think of going to Jerusalem. Who had come to Jerusalem for the festivals? David also left breaches in the wall to make it easier for the throngs of pilgrims to enter the city. Since the new palace of Solomon's queen, the daughter of Paro, was adjacent to the Milo, so it actually wasn't her palace, it was right next to this other location. Right, the king exported the area to build quarters for her servant, thus severely restricting access to the holy city and angering the populace. So the first paragraph doesn't sound there's any tolls, it's just that he built extra areas in which it was impossible to go through because he built areas for the servant of the daughter of the king of Egypt. Then we look at the next paragraph. Before Yeroboam, however, no one dared criticize Solomon for his actions. Rashi writes that Yeroboam accused Solomon of letting the queen control access to the city so that she could enrich herself by collecting tolls from anyone who wished to enter. Again, it doesn't, not Rashi here, but Rashi in the Talmud says that statement.
She was cheap with her. He didn't give her money, so
Right, so she needed to get money from, right, so, you know. The Yad Ramah points out that this was a false charge because the righteous Solomon would not have done such a thing, and furthermore, he was so wealthy that he surely did not require such an underhanded means to provide her with revenue. So you can say, well, maybe he was cheap and he didn't give her anything. It's hard to believe, especially when we know the palace that he built for her, which was magnificent on its own, to say that she needed to collect a couple bucks on the Marine Parkway Bridge, you know, or the other bridge that they now we have to pay for. Do we have to pay for it now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, lovely. So, you know, because we need extra revenue. No, the king doesn't need extra revenue. All right. And we look over here. The question is, how could he have had the audacity to do something? The next paragraph in English, just the first and last sentence, says, on page 123, the verse explains how Yeroboam could have had the audacity to insult Solomon publicly. You look to the last sentence over here, it says that he was a tax collector, an occupation that incurs animosity. So sometimes when you can say to yourself, how could you speak so poorly against a leader such as the king? Look at what their profession is. If it's a person of dignity and an intellectual individual, that's a person that probably is going to be a little bit more apprehensive and careful in what they say and do. You're dealing with someone who is a tax collector, who bangs on your door and takes your money, who's a pushy individual, someone who also, their whole focus is money, their whole interest is money, and they think that because they have money, all of a sudden everything else, that's the only thing that matters, all of a sudden they think that they're important, and therefore they can push other people around. And that's precisely the reason why Yeroboam felt that he was able to do so. And that was the mistake. He did not show proper respect. And even when you rebuke, you have to show respect. And that's what the very last line the Radak says over here. And the Radak actually says something which nowadays doesn't really matter. But the Radak says on the very last line, page 122, that, again, he rebuked him in public, which obviously shows he didn't respect leadership. Furthermore, V'omer Razal, my v'zeh hadavar asher harim lo, v'melech, what did he do that showed a lack of respect? And nowadays, this doesn't matter, but in the good old days, it mattered. Shecholetz tefillah befanav. He was wearing tefillin, and he took off his tefillin in front of the king. Right? As and when you take off the tefillin in front of your king, you're wearing a hat. You take off your hat. Right? So you open up and you have your head exposed. And when you're before God, men have to wear a kippah because men have more difficulty remembering the oneness of God throughout the day. So a man wears a kippah to remember that there's a God. To take off my hat shows the lack of respect. So it's the same thing when it comes to a king. So when he took off his tefillin, he was also showing lack of respect as though you do not matter. And for that reason, he became a leader, but he still did something wrong by doing that. Now let's see a couple more sentences. Let's get a little bit more into to what happens in the story. Pasuk Chaf Ches, verse 28, page 122. He was no slouch. He was powerful, well respected, a man of valor. The Yar Shlomo as Haynar. Now he was a nar. At the time, this is not written in chronological order. As Rashi says, this happened before, that when he was a youngster, he noticed his position of power and his strength. He also malacha, who, he was a person that did work. He was a worker. He tried. He was a motivated person. Therefore, Shlomo felt, put him in a position of power, because he's a worker. And he put him over the position of taxation over the house of Yosef. So he gave him a strong position of power because he saw leadership qualities in him. And it was in this time, says Pasuk of Tess, let's just see a few sentences over here, an unbelievable story which unfolds. V'yaravam yatsim Yerushalayim. Yaravam exits Yerushalayim. He leaves Jerusalem. And some say this comes to teach us he didn't just leave Jerusalem physically, but he left spiritually. The element of his connection to the Beit HaMikdash and the importance of going there, Yatsa, he left Jerusalem. The Yimsa Oso Achia Hashiloni. This is a person that we're not familiar with, but he was a Navi. And his name was Achia Hashiloni, who approached him, a Navi. But there he saw him on the road. Bumischase Besalma Chadasha. He was wearing a beautiful new garment. Ushnehem Levadam Basada. They were both all alone in the field.
I don't understand. Why would Yeravam leave if he was appointed to a high position? Why was he leaving?
It doesn't really say where he was going or what was happening.
I mean, I would think that he would have stayed.
Right. It's possible that after he rebuked him, as we're going to see the latter part of this chapter, how Solomon wishes to kill him because you're rebelling against me, right? By rebuking me in public. So it could be by him leaving was almost a way of escaping, running away, after having rebuked him in an inappropriate manner. Maybe. So he had this beautiful new garment, and they were both alone in the field. So let's just see a couple more sentences. For Yispos, since we understand the significance of this garment, for Yispos Achia Basalma Chadasha. So Achia HaSalma grabbed hold, who was this prophet, this beautiful new garment, Asher Lov, which was upon him. It's questionable who was wearing the garment. We're going to see who it was. To Machlokas. We're not sure who wore this garment. Whether it was the prophet that was wearing the garment, or it was Yeravam ben Nevat. V'yikra'eha shneim aser kroyim. He took the garment and he ripped it up into many pieces. How many? No coincidence. 12. Why 12? The Yomul Yeravam, the prophet, said to Yeravam, Kach lecha asar kraim, take 10 pieces of this rendered garment. Ki komor Hashem Elkei Yisrael, so says God, Hini koreas hamamlacha miyad Shlomo. Interesting, by the way, the word for a garment is what? A salma, and which is being ripped, and the king's name is Shlomo. The exact same letters. Shin, Lamed, Mem, He. The Shlomo, his essence is being torn asunder, being ripped to shreds. That which he represents as a king, through this simla, this salma, this garment is being ripped up, which is Shlomo. It's no coincidence. It's the same word, because taking away a man's position, which was his essence, is equivalent to ripping that person to shreds. V'nosati lucha es asar hashvatim. And I will give to you 10 tribes. One tribe will go to him, namely the descendant of King Shlomo, namely Rehoboam. Even though we know it's not really one, it's really two, but Binyamin and Yehuda are really interconnected. Oman Avdi David, not because of Shlomo's merit, because of David's merit. Oman Yerushalayim Ha'ir Asher Bacharti Bo, in the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen, Mikol Shevti Yisrael, from all the nations of Israel. So we see that this garment is ripped to shreds. And what exactly is the symbolism over here of who ripped the garment, who didn't rip, whose garment it was? So we look in the Radak. The Radak says as follows. On Pasuk Chavtes, about two lines before the lines get wide. The Chain B'divri Razal. It's brought down by our rabbis of blessed memory. There's a dispute between Rav and Levi. Chad Omer Simla So Shalachia. One say that the garment belonged to this prophet. V'chad Omer Simla So Shal Yerubim. That he ripped up Yerubim's garment. Yerubim was walking around in the garment. He shredded it up. Omer Rebbe Shmuel Mastabir. It's more logical, first wide line, Kamandi Omer Shalachia. That it belonged to the prophet, this garment. Shekin derech shel tzaddikim. It's the way of the righteous. Leos kodim b'machlokas shel beis David. That when they hear that there is a dispute, it affects the scholar the most. When it comes to the Talmud Chacham, to the tzaddik, when they hear that there's a lack of peace and unity, it tears them apart the most. We say on Shabbat, right at the end of In Kelokeinu, we say Talmidei Chachamim marvim shalom b'olam. If a Talmud Chacham does not focus on peace, then it's a direct contradiction on the integrity of that person, whether or not the person's a Talmud Chacham. A Talmud Chacham, which embodies Torah, in essence, is someone who always tries to embrace peace as much as possible. And therefore, in the event that he saw that there was a dispute, he ripped up this garment which he was wearing. And if we just look over here in the English, what does it mean that says they were alone? Why? Who cares? They were alone, they were in a field. So it's brought down on the bottom of page 124, homiletically, the very last two lines over there. It says, homiletically, they were such outstanding Torah scholars. We should not forget, again, Yerubim and Nevut, we're going to see worship idols. But he's not going to be appointed as a king because he was a lowlife. He was obviously great. So concluding with the following thought. Homiletically, there were such outstanding Torah scholars that compared to them, other scholars, what does it mean they were alone in a field? It means other scholars were as insignificant as grass in the field. That it doesn't mean that necessarily even they were alone, but it means Yerubim was so great that he stood alone in stature. And that's the reason why he was chosen, because he was a brilliant man. But of course, whenever we have any abilities, any skills, any qualities that God gives us, those are exactly that. They're gifts from God. Never to think for a moment that I'm the one that created this wisdom. Because, as I often say, we're fortunate to be where we are. We could have been born, God forbid, in a third world country, wondering where we're going to get our next morsel of bread. The fact we are where we are, and the fact that we have the comforts that we have, does not mean that we're better than other people. We're no better than anyone else, but what we are more responsible to be able to help others. That's our obligation. And Yerubim, despite his wisdom, his mistake is going to be that he allowed his power to get to his head as though it was coming from him. You always have to remain with a proper thought that it's not coming from me. It's not something which I created, but rather it's a gift from the Almighty, it's a gift from God.